And hello and welcome to Writers on Writing on KUCI FM 88.9 in Irvine. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're on the web at kuci.org and on iTunes on College Radio. Today is Wednesday, July 4th, 2018. Happy 4th of July. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. And my guest today for the entire hour is Peter Janay. Peter has been a book editor and publisher for more than three decades. Peter was the founder, publisher, and editorial director of Bloomsbury Press, an imprint of Bloomsbury USA. Before that, he held editorial positions at Oxford University Press, Crown Publishers, St. Martin's Press, and Persia Books. He's taught in New York University's publishing program and in the Columbia Publishing Course. Peter comments about books and publishing on the blog Dr. Syntax, and you can find him on Twitter at Dr. Syntax. He's here today to primarily talk about his book, What Editors Do, The Art, Craft, and Business of Book Editing. Hi, Peter.
Hi.
Great to have you on.
Great to be on.
Thank you. Your book came a while ago, and then I saw you on a panel at the LA Times Festival of Books, and I put it together that you were the writer of this book or the editor of this book. And so it was great to meet you there and now to talk with you. Let's talk about, at least begin talking about how the book came about.
Well, it sort of was kismet in a way. It's as I mentioned in the beginning of What Editors Do, There's no, for people who work in publishing who want to become editors, there's really very little in the way of training programs or organized courses or in-house even training in publishing houses. It's sort of a very old-fashioned profession in that you tend to learn it by apprenticeship, working for another editor and sort of seeing over that person's shoulder how they go about their job. And learning by osmosis, and it's a great way to learn in many ways, but it's also haphazard, and it means that there's a lot of how you learn to be an editor really depends a lot on the kind of person that you work for and how effective a mentor they are. So when I got into the business in the 1980s. I kind of cast around for anything that I could read to help me get a handle on what I was supposed to be doing. And there was a book then called Editors on Editing. It was a collection of essays by editors then about their work. And it was a really useful book written by with essays by a lot of very sort of high-profile and distinguished editors in the field. That book was, at that point, sort of 30 years old, and it's still in print now because it still has value. But it was published before there was Amazon, before there was social media, before there was online bookselling or e-books. So I really felt it would be great to have a book that kind of updated that whole approach and tried to talk about publishing as it's done now. And I'd been thinking about that sort of every time a young person came into my office asking for advice about publishing or how to be an editor or what to do with their career and so on. And one day as I was sort of brooding about this, I got a query from the University of Chicago Press asking if I would be interested in putting together a book like that. So it was a great sort of fortuitous combination of interest, theirs and mine, and that's how I embarked on the project with my publishers at the University of Chicago Press.
So how did you become a book editor? How did you find your way to that profession?
Like a lot of people, I kind of wandered sideways into publishing from doing from something else that I imagined I would be doing, from academia, which is where a lot of people kind of wander into publishing from. I had sort of imagined going to university and come out of it imagining I wanted to be a sort of professor, went to graduate school, and I was in the middle of graduate school. I'd sort of started my first year there and thought, for a variety of reasons, oh, wow, I really need to take a break from this. I've been sitting around schools for, you know, 18 years in a row or something now, and I want to take a break. And I'm still interested in kind of teaching, but I don't want to do another year of school right now. And then I had to figure out something I could actually do instead. And I'd always been sort of interested in and good at kind of editorial things. I'd edited, you know, my friends' papers in college or worked on school newspapers and things like that. I knew people, including my father, who had been in the book business. And I thought, this is something I might have an aptitude for. And I wound up sort of getting a job in this very small independent publishing house, and realizing after about 6 months of doing that I was having way more fun in publishing than I'd been having in grad school. And so I just stayed in the business, and here I am 35 years later or whatever it is.
I didn't realize that you founded Bloomsbury Press. What motivated that?
I mean, the terminology of publishing is confusing in all kinds of ways, as I also talk about in the book. Bloomsbury Press, the imprint that I founded, became part of an existing Bloomsbury USA publishing operation.
Mm-hmm.
Bloomsbury USA existed, which was itself a branch of the Bloomsbury house that had started in London about 10 years before. I came to Bloomsbury after working at Oxford University Press because they wanted then to start a sort of a line of books, an imprint specifically devoted to serious nonfiction. And that's kind of what had been the meat of what I was doing for the previous 10 years at OUP. And it was a great opportunity. It's something you don't get to do very often in publishing, kind of start a list from scratch. And it was kind of an offer too good to refuse, as they say. So I moved from Oxford to Bloomsbury and had a great, a very exciting, fun time kind of developing that list of books, which, as I say, is an all nonfiction list within the larger trade publishing operation of Bloomsbury.
Yeah. Interesting. If you just tuned in, we are talking with Peter Genet. His book is What Editors Do, The Art, Craft, and Business of Book Editing, published by University of Chicago Press. So the book is broken out into chronological chapters from an editor acquiring a book to someone pursuing a career in editing. Can you talk about laying out the book, the structure of the book, and how that happened, as well as then finding the various writers, editors to do the various chapters?
Sure. The one of the things that we try to do in the book is to include a lot of the different kinds of book publishing that goes on in the U.S., not just trade book publishing, the books that you find in bookstores that most people think of when you say book publishing, but textbooks, academic monographs, small press, even self-publishing. I wanted to find a way of conveying kind of what things all editors do that they have in common across all these different categories. Because acquisitions and editing, or text development, as I sometimes call it, and the publishing part, the part of where you're bringing the book out into the world, into the marketplace, all of those things you have to do, whether you're in a reference publisher or a kids book publisher or a big random house, or Grey Wolf Press, a small independent publisher. And so those sort of fundamental pieces of the job, acquisitions, editing, publication, are the basic phases of an editor's job. And so that's how the book is organized. One reason for having that kind of structure and sort of kind of doing the chapters the way that we organized them was to try and avoid overlap of everybody writing about the same thing. If I just said to 27 colleagues, write about your job as an editor, you'd hear the same thing over and over. So I wanted, that's one reason why I wanted people to focus on these different aspects of their work so that we could sort of see how the job unfolds from, as it were, from the beginning, from the idea germinating in the author's head to the point where somebody goes into a bookstore and plucks the book off the shelf.
So I'm also thinking, you know, you being an editor, how was it then working with an editor, working with the editor of the book?
Well, my editor at Chicago, his name is Mary Lauer, and who's terrific, she and I used to just get laughing sometimes about the fact that we were editors editing other editors writing about editing other authors, and it sort of becomes absurdly meta pretty quickly. But it was an interesting experience for me. I've written a couple of published pieces before, but I've never sort of really been the author of a substantial book like this. And I quickly found out that I was doing as an author, some of the same things that used to drive me crazy when I was an editor dealing with authors, like, sort of pushing my deadlines and asking persnickety questions about the jacket design and all kinds of things like that. And, of course, since I was then editing the writing of a list of contributors who are, I think, sort of an all-star team of really, really good people in the field, that was a little intimidating to work with an editor who's published any number of bestsellers and Pulitzer Prize and National Book Award winners, and you're going to edit them now. It's a little intimidating. But in fact, all of my colleagues who contributed chapters were great to work with. They were, as you might expect or at least hope, they were super professional. They were very gracious and responsive to being edited. And it was actually a really fun experience. I was happy that I had sort of undertaken the thing once it was over.
So I'm wondering, for the listeners who perhaps have never been through the editing process, can we talk a little bit about that? An editor receives a manuscript, most likely through an agent. What happens next? And as well, I'm curious if most editors, or if you, would go more with gut reaction, or is marketing very much a part of the acquisition process? So I guess there's a couple of questions in there.
Right. Well, I mean, one of the things that I try to say with some emphasis in what editors do, and I think, well, I mean, my own essays, chapters in the book say this, and other people, I think, sort of get at it in different ways, but there's this, especially in the last several years, as we've had kind of a burgeoning self-publishing movement, and you see the contrast between kind of institutionalized commercial or academic, you know, traditional publishing and self-publishing. A lot of stress has been sort of, and negative connotations, I think, have been put around the idea of the editor as a gatekeeper, which makes it sound like they're kind of a bouncer in a club turning people away. Because, of course, it's a pretty well-known fact I'm sure you talk about it on this program frequently, most submissions to publishers get rejected. Publishers have to filter things. They have to turn people down. But the fact is, editors don't like turning people down. They don't live, they don't get their kicks by saying no to authors. What draws you into the business and keeps you going in it is that you love books and you have a capacity to be excited by books. And so the first thing, the question that you ask yourself is, it is the gut reaction question. It's like, does this excite me? When I read this, do I sort of feel my pulse quickening as I turn the pages? And it's when you start to have that reaction, at least for me, that's when I think, okay, maybe this is a thing that I'm going to want to try and publish. I write about this a little bit in the chapter on acquisitions in this book, and you know, I call that feeling the spark. You there's something about this manuscript or the proposal strikes a spark in your mind, your sensibility, and you're excited about it. And the question I really ask myself is, when I get to the last page of this piece of writing, do I have the urge to tell somebody else, you got to read this? Because that, in the most fundamental way, is what publishing is about, saying to people, you got to read this. And I think one of the things that many contributors to this book say, in different ways in different chapters, is if you don't love a book, you shouldn't try to acquire it. You shouldn't try to publish a book that you don't love. It's too hard. I mean, it's too hard to publish any book. An enormous amount of effort and mental and psychological energy has to be expended, not just by the author, but by the editor and other people in the publishing house, to publish a book effectively. And if you do that, you're trying to do that for a book that you aren't passionate about, it's just drudgery. And it always somehow results in a publication where it doesn't go as well as it should, and authors are frequently unhappy when that happens. So the gut reaction is really important. But as I say, you know, I put in the subtitle of the book, The Art, Craft, and Business of Book Publishing, for a reason. The reason is, publishing is a business. You have to sell a product. And even if you're in a not-for-profit academic press, even if you're in a literary press, independent press with a very literary, altruistic mission, if you're going to publish more books in the future, you have to make enough money on the ones that you're publishing now to keep the lights on and keep the staff employed. So you have to think about the marketing considerations. You have to think about, how am I going to sell this book? And again, I think when people from outside sometimes, or people, very idealistic people getting into publishing, starting their editorial careers, sometimes they're sort of repulsed by the idea of marketing. It sounds so crass and commercial, and we're here trafficking in truth and beauty. But it's your job as the publisher to put the book in the hands of readers. And that's the service that you offer to the author. So to be above marketing is not really, it does a disservice to yourself as a business and to your author as a client. So you should think hard about how you're going to sort of flog the product when you have it, even if it's lyric poetry or exquisite coming-of-age novels or whatever. And that's really part of where the craft that I talk about comes in. There are sort of tricks of the trade. There are best practices. There are ways that you learn to think about, how am I going to find the audience for something. Really, the tricky part, in some ways, and this is actually a creative part, I think, of being an editor or a publisher, is how do you connect what the author has written with the kind of person who's going to respond to it. How do you find that audience that's going to be excited the same way you were when you turn that last page? How do you find other people when you have that feeling, I got to tell somebody about this? Who is that somebody? And because not every book is for every reader, even though we call, you know, some books general interest books, but as a colleague of mine once said, there's no such thing as a general reader. There's just 476 kinds of individual readers. You know, I'm interested in a lot of different things, but I'm not interested in everything. Mm-hmm. When I was young and cocky as an editorial, sort of junior editor, I thought, I can edit anything. You know, I can sort of how-to books, celebrity memoirs, mysteries, serious biography, all of those things I read and like and can work on successfully. I thought, I can do anything. And then I had to edit my first romance novel, and I just realized, you know, there's some things I can't edit. romance and cookbooks were, and science fiction were things I couldn't edit.
Mm-hmm. Well, so it sounds like the process is the same whether you're reading fiction or nonfiction or whatever it is. It begins with the gut reaction.
Absolutely. I mean, now that you proceed fairly quickly when you start thinking about the marketing piece. And the reason you have to, one other reason you have to think about the marketing piece is you're going to have to make a financial arrangement with the author. You're going to have to offer a contract and pay this person money for their book, which they certainly deserve. So you have to try and make some kind of a guess about how many copies you can sell and what the price is and all that kind of thing. And so you need to start trying to get a sense of how big the potential audience is for something, the ways that you're going to go about reaching that audience and what kind of investment you have to make in marketing to do that. And so with a nonfiction book, you have a lot more sort of data points, if you like, to think about in terms of, Is it a vegan cookbook? You know a lot about where to reach people who do vegan cooking and shop for vegan recipes. Is it a hard-hitting expose of some big political scandal? You've got some idea of what other hard-hitting exposés have done in the past. And so you can sort of, and you try to accumulate as much of that kind of information that's going to help you get a sense of how big the potential audience is that you're marketing to. With fiction, or, you know, sort of literary nonfiction sometimes, or memoirs or something like that, it's so much more dependent on the reading experience that you're sort of doing more on guesswork, and that's where the author's own track record becomes very important. It's important in both fiction and nonfiction, but especially when you don't have the nonfiction sort of information to go on, and then you're trying to. A lot of publishers spend a lot of time in their acquisition meetings thinking about what they call comp titles, comparable books. What was like this memoir that we think might give us an idea of what the ballpark is that we could sell, in terms of the number of copies we can sell. But it's all educated guesswork when you get right down to it, and publishers guess wrong lots and lots of the time. That's, you just have to accept that that's par for the course.
So what about authors that cross over from, say, nonfiction to fiction? I've heard that you don't bring your readers with you from one genre to the next. Is there any truth to that?
Well, I don't think that's completely true, but I think it's like a lot of things that people say in publishing. You know, it's true, but it depends. I mean, I think some authors are so connected with their readers and have such devoted fans. I mean, if J.K. Rowling wrote a nonfiction book, I mean, people would read it by the millions.
Mm-hmm.
If Stephen King wrote a nonfiction book, I mean, he has. He's written an excellent book on writing, as I'm sure you know.
Yes.
You know, it's not going to be the same as the audience for The Shining or something, but there are people who are going to follow him across categories because they like his voice, they like his sensibility, they sort of are fans of him personally. So, I mean, John Grisham has gone back and forth sometimes. So, I think that in publishers, in their sort of at their crassest, would always prefer that an author write virtually the same book that they wrote the last time if the book was successful, because that's just the easiest thing to sell. I mean, an example that I use in the book is Sue Grafton wrote this terrific mystery series, which went through the alphabet. You know, A is for alibi, mm-hmm. B is for body or whatever. You know, and it's like, publishers love something like that because, you know, S is for suspect. You are pretty sure that it's going to, R is for, I can't remember what it was, you know, that R and S are going to be pretty similar in how they sell. The next one, T is for, I can't remember what that was either. But, you know, people love having, and publishers love a book where you're marketing the same audience. They liked it the last time. They're going to like it again. You just hope to sort of grow it a little bit more this time.
Yeah.
It's very straightforward. It means you don't, and because this is the catch of what is so great about being editor is that every book is different. Every book's unique. And you're constantly learning new things and reading something you never read before. That's what keeps the job interesting. But it's also what makes it really hard as a commercial proposition, because you're inventing the wheel every time you go out to market something. So that's why, you know, publishers love books that are in series and love it when a person who writes historical novels set in Elizabethan England writes another historical novel set in Elizabethan England, and you know, wouldn't be so happy if they wrote a gritty noir, you know, set in South Central Los Angeles. There are sometimes friction between authors and publishers over that, because authors appropriately want to be creative and do something new and challenge themselves, and they have fresh ideas, and it doesn't always, they're not always going to make publishers happy by sort of cranking out the same product that they did last time. So to get back to the question you were asking, do you lose your audience if you move from fiction to nonfiction or vice versa? That is, you know, there's definitely, you're going to lose some of them, and it's hard to think of many people who have successfully written on both sides of the fiction-nonfiction divide. But some people do it, and I think if you execute the thing brilliantly enough, then you'll find an audience, a new audience maybe, on the other side of crossing that genre barrier.
So in terms of series, I mean, series are pretty common, probably in the mystery genre, perhaps most of all, I don't know, maybe romance. I don't read romance, so I can't speak to that. But what about other fiction genres? I mean, you know, how would that apply so that you're kind of, you know, staying within the genre, creating some sort of, I don't know, illusion of a series? I don't know.
Well, I mean, there are lots of different strategies, and not to keep plugging my own book here, but there's a really interesting chapter in it by Diana Gill, who's a editor now at Tor Books, about sort of being a genre books editor, working in science fiction, romance, mystery, and the sort of considerations that go into series, trilogies. Science fiction is rife with things like trilogies and tetralogies. As I was saying a minute ago, there's that kind of perpetual tension between the desire to do something new and stretch yourself as a writer and the reassuring knowledge that your fans will come back for more if you're delivering something like what you did before. And you know, you've got somebody like James Patterson who writes sort of multiple, or Michael Connelly, kind of writing multiple series, starting a new character, and then if that works out, kind of developing a series with him or her. You have some people who, and I'm not thinking of anybody off the top of my head, but I'm sure I would if I rattled my brain a little longer, who write sort of books with very similar kinds of settings and setups, or overlapping, you know, characters. I mean, John le Carré, in a way, has written, you know, books that are sort of all set within the same sort of universe, and sometimes a character from one will pop up as a peripheral character in another. And so even though, you know, if you're a George Smiley fan, you might not get a full Smiley book, but Smiley's kind of in, you know, pops into the frame occasionally in some of the other books. And then, you know, le Carré sort of, well, to the great gratification of those fans, to bring him back for a full book occasionally. So I think people navigate that in sort of a variety of different ways.
You are listening to Writers on Writing. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I've been with Peter Genet. His book is What Editors Do, The Art, Craft, and Business of Book Editing, published by University of Chicago Press. You mentioned that chapter by Ms. Gill, and then and earlier you were talking about self-publishing, and I am curious why, I think in your introduction you say there are certain genres such as fantasy, thriller, or romance that do well as self-published books. Why those genres and not, say, literary fiction or I don't know, memoir? Why is that?
That's a good question. I think the reason, one reason is that it sort of follows on from what we were saying before about genres, which is the problem with self-publishing is you have to get people interested in your book, and they have no idea who you are. You're not coming with the imprimatur of a big publisher. You don't have the sales reps out telling people in bookstores that you should be stocking this book because the editors at Random House have determined it's a really fantastic literary novel or a mystery. You have to sort of, what's going to make somebody pick up your book by you that they've never heard of? And one of the ways that you do that is by writing in a genre that people are already looking for. If you write a hard-boiled noir mystery, there's a big audience, you know, that likes hard-boiled noir mysteries, and you know, Raymond Chandler and Dashiell Hammett aren't writing them anymore, and there's only so many of them coming out from the big commercial houses, and people who like those kinds of books also tend to read them pretty quickly. I mean, I think of some people like my mother-in-law who used to go to the library and come back with 10 books and then go back 3 days later for 10 more. And she was reading, you know, mysteries and historical novels and thrillers and a lot of things. But she, you know, they're voracious readers in these genres. And so they're looking for a new book every couple of days sometimes. And one of the strategies a lot of self-publishers use is to price their books low, and which you can do, you can sell a book on an e-book for a couple dollars online. And so people are like, well, for $2, why not try this? I know I like hard-boiled mysteries. Here's one for $2. I can, if I don't like it, I'll just stop reading. And a lot of people can write a pretty good mystery that way and develop an audience. And I think the same is true. I mean, romance is a genre where people read voraciously. Science fiction, ditto. Erotica, also a huge self-publishing category. And so it's not that you can't be successful with a freestanding, you know, more sui generis, unique kind of book, but you're tapping into an existing avid fan community and people who are really looking for something that you're, you know, of the kind that you're writing when you are working in those genres.
So if there are voracious readers of, say, hard-boiled noir mysteries, why aren't publishers publishing more of them?
That's a good question. I think that it's partly that for one thing, there are sort of questions of scale, and publishers are looking for books that are going to sell sort of large numbers of copies, and they, you know, to make their margins work and generate the kind of revenue that a Penguin Random House or a HarperCollins, one of the big five houses, needs to see. You're looking for books that are going to sell in the tens of thousands rather than the 2,000 and 3,000 or 5,000. And it's often the case that the audiences for these genre books are steady but small. It may be that those readers are not so keen on paying $25 for a book. That's an issue. If you want to put out a new hardcover book, it's going to be probably $22, $25 or more dollars. And it's, you know, publishers have experimented with publishing original paperbacks or original e-books. Some of those, and they are doing, Amazon's doing a lot of that kind of publishing. They're not dumb. Doing kind of lower priced ebook originals and things like that, and sort of meeting the demand that way. But it's, you know, I mean, I'd have to talk to the sort of CEOs of those companies to know kind of what their long-term strategy is about you know, which kinds of genres they're really investing in. It's an interesting question.
I love this quote by Tom Englehart in Chapter 18, Lives That Matter, a chapter written by Wendy Wolfe. All fine writers lay down a path for you, the editor. All you have to do is find it in the verbal undergrowth, set foot upon it, and then it's all remarkably simple. You're doing your best to slip inside another mind and help unknot the words and thoughts that stood between a writer and the book he or she imagined. I love that. And it makes me think that the best editors want their work to be invisible.
I think that's always true. I mean, the whole secret, really, to editing and in terms of the working with an author on the manuscript part of editing is to, I mean, Tom uses the first phrase, slip inside the mind. I always think of it as sort of aligning yourself, aligning your sensibility with that of the author. And I mean, I would 100% agree with what he says. You're trying to sort of figure out what the book is trying to be and help that book be the best version of itself that it can be, not to be the book that you would have written if you were doing it. And there's sometimes, I think, a failing of editors when editors are not at their best. Sometimes they try to impose their taste or their ideas on an author. But the best editors really figure out where the author is trying to go, where the book is trying to go. Sometimes it's something the author doesn't even know except subliminally. And help it get there. And that's I think, is the art. That's why the word art is in the subtitle of my book, because I think that's the art of it.
So I know, I mean, at least I've heard publishing used to be way different, where editors, you know, spent a lot of time helping a writer craft a book, and these days there's not enough time for an editor to do that. And so how perfect then does a manuscript have to be? I'm thinking also of, you know, authors all the time who say, you know, I sent my book in, I got an editor, the editor said cut the first 100 pages, we cut the first 100 pages, you know, we made a perfect book. So obviously the book that editor received was not perfect until they worked together. So how does that work then? I mean, does an editor see sort of the bones of a story, or see what a, you know, have a vision of what a book can be? It's close enough so that they're willing to and want to get involved with it?
Right. I mean, the first of all, I want to push back a little on the idea that sort of, you know, nobody spends enough time anymore, because this is a thing you hear all the time when you're in the publishing business. Editors don't edit anymore. And as my wife and children could tell you, I spent enormous numbers of hours as an editor when other people were doing things with their families, sort of standing there with my pencil and manuscript in front of me. And every editor that I know does that. It's all work that you do outside of office hours, pretty much, because it's really hard to get the kind of blocks of time that you need to do that work in an office day where you've got meetings and phone calls and all that stuff. So, I mean, it can take hours and hours and weeks and months to edit a manuscript, and I think it's definitely harder for editors to find that time, especially in commercial houses now. The pressure of sort of getting books out is sorry, I've got another phone is going on here. So it's challenging, but it's still something that people take very, very seriously as a responsibility, the responsibility to kind of, you know, work closely line by line with the author on the manuscript. And Jeff Schatz, who's written a chapter in the book about independent publishing, lays a fair amount of stress on the fact that, especially in the independent houses like his, Grey Wolf, that putting that time in is really something that they think of as part of their mission. So I do think it's still something that goes on. You have to make a decision anytime you're looking at a book as a potential acquisition. How much time am I going to have to invest in this to get this book to where it needs to be successfully publishable? And sometimes the book really needs work, and you think it's worth, you know, I'm going to have to spend weeks and weeks and weeks or months, scores of hours getting this book in the shape it needs to be in. But there's something so special about it that it's worth it to me to do that. In other cases, you sometimes read something and think, this could be great, it could be very successful, it could be a fantastic contribution to knowledge or a great literary masterpiece, but I don't know if I can. Sometimes you make this decision on the basis of talking to the author and finding out you're not completely on the same wavelength. Either I don't have the time to put into this, or I'm not in sync enough. I don't have that alignment. I can't slip into this author's mind the way I would need to, or he's not going to agree to let me do it to get the book to the place where it becomes publishable. And sometimes you make a judgment call about that. And again, that's another thing that you have to be willing to say. Sometimes you're going to get it wrong. Bob Gottlieb, the great longtime editor of Knopf, wrote a memoir which he talks about, and it's a well-known story in publishing. You know, turning down the manuscript of A Confederacy of Dunces by Tool, and which went on to be a prize winner and bestseller. I mean, after being turned down by many, many publishers, and he says very frankly, I stand by my opinion that I had at the time that this book didn't work for me at that level for me to think that I could turn it into what I thought it ought to be. And I think was that a wrong decision? I mean, it might look like that in retrospect, but I don't think it is from the editor's point of view.
We have just a few minutes left, and we could use a whole lot more time.
There's
so much more to talk about. I've always been curious if editors have feelings about agents in terms of, you know, an agent comes to you with a project and you love the agent, so you're going to look at anything he or she sends you, or you can't stand the agent, so you're not going to look at anything he or she sends you. Is it always the work? Is it always sort of, you know, writers query agents, agents query editors? Is it very much a relationship business on your end in terms of who you do business with in terms of acquiring manuscripts?
Well, I mean, relationships are really important, and that's partly because, I mean, agents are an important filter for the publisher. I mean, you get literally thousands of projects sent to you as an editor in a year if you're in a sizable house. I mean, many of them just over the transom, no agent involved, and even then you're turning down hundreds of proposals or submissions from agents. So if there's an agent whose judgment you really trust, who says, I know this book's going to be right for you, or I think this book can be very successful, you do get that work a closer look, and you sort of put it on the top of your reading pile, certainly, because it's got a meaningful endorsement to you. There are some cases where, I think a lot of agents are, I think most agents are good, and some agents are terrific. There are some agents who are bad, by which I mean they don't do a good job for their clients. A very, very, very small, subset of those are people that are actively untrustworthy. That doesn't happen very often, but there are some agents where you think, unless this book is brilliant and a surefire bestseller, it's just not worth it to me to do business with this person. But that's a very, very small list, I think, in any editor's head. The more significant list is the one where you, if it comes in from a certain person, you go, I know this is going to be a plausible candidate. And the really good agents, the best ones, match up what they have to your taste, your expertise, and your track record. And so you know that they've really sort of thought about sending it to you for a reason. And those people, get the most favorable, the most sympathetic readings. But again, ultimately, you have to make a judgment about what's on the page.
And writers don't tend to know who those agents are.
It's hard. It's hard to know who they are. And not every agent is right for every. I say there's a there are some agents who are terrific, but not every terrific agent is terrific for every author.
Mm-hmm.
It's a personal chemistry thing, and it's like editors. They have to be in sync with your sensibility, get what you're trying to do. I work with a lot of historians and scholars and people who are writing books that are sort of written for general readers, but they're very kind of part of an academic or scholarly discourse as well. And some agents who are very good just don't understand the academic world that all those authors live in very well. And they're consequently not so great at doing the kind of career management that also is part of what agents are supposed to be doing. So every author has to try and find a person that is just on the same wavelength as he or she is, and that's part of what's tricky about finding an agent.
Mm. Oh, Peter Genet, it's been a great pleasure having you on the show. I'm sorry we're at the end of our time again.
Me too. This was a great conversation. Thank you.
And thank you so much for writing this book. This is going to be so useful, or continues to be useful to writers everywhere. So thank you.
My pleasure.
That was Peter Genet. His book is What Editors Do, The Art, Craft, and Business of Book Editing, published by University of Chicago Press. Very useful. So much great information. And check it out. I love it. I'm at the end of my time here this morning. Have a great 4th of July. Stay safe. Maybe you find a few minutes to get some writing done. And see you back here next week.